to this best of episode, where we've pulled together a collection of our favourite bits from season 3. Before we get into the episode, I'd like to heartily thank all of my guests for spending an hour or so with me, virtually at least. Also, thanks to all of our sponsors who've supported the podcast this season. Thanks to the team at Audio Boom for their continued work, and to Debbie Allen and her team at Curtis Brown. And also, massive thanks to my producer, Dan Quick. But most of all, thanks to you for listening this season. I really hope you've enjoyed it. As always, the music throughout this series was by the fabulous Waiting for Smith. You can check out more of his music on Spotify and find him on social media. To find my peace, where the desert feasts, will welcome you in peace. And the monkeys go. You say your shows aren't themed, but you're not frightened to sort of shy away from personal stuff, from real stuff.
No, I think that's the majority of stuff I talk about is about myself, really. Yeah.
And it was a friend of mine wanted me to say this to you, in fact, but a friend of mine just became type 1, just found out she was type 1 diabetic, and
oh, wow.
Found you talking about it incredibly helpful, because up until then, the only feedback had been through quite serious medical provision, and actually hearing somebody with that experience going, this is what's shit about it, but
yeah,
this is what's interesting about it, really helped.
I've had a few people tell me that. It's been really nice. I've had messages from parents of diabetic kids as well saying that me chatting about it in a lighthearted way has really helped, which is great. And that was never my intention when I was doing it. I was just trying to talk about my life. And it is a massive part of my life. Like, it's like having another full-time job, really, trying to look after it. But, you know, some really funny stuff happens because of it. And, you know, it's not going to get me down all of the time. So... I think that does help people to hear that, because it can, if you worry about it too much, it can become all consuming. So I think it's always good to hear that other people are going through the same thing.
You say it's like a full-time job, and it does. It certainly appears that way. The constant monitoring of one's self is, certainly when you're young, it's not something you expect to be doing, is it?
No, not at all. And to be fair, I was diagnosed when I was 13, and for a long time, I didn't do a lot of that. I didn't do a lot of the monitoring need. I did the bare minimum. And then probably in my early 20s, I was like, right, I've really got to knuckle down and try and get on top of this. And then there's a sort of period where it does become all consuming. You're like, I'm never going to be able to work out how to do this and have a life. But you can, you definitely can. But it's just about keeping an eye on it.
And there's lots of, my mate, there's lots of weighing of things.
Yeah, I think you get better at that. So I did a course at Kingston Hospital where you sort of learn how to, it's a Daphne course, but it's not. It's dose adjustment for normal eating. So you basically learn how to calculate carbs in things and give the right amount of insulin to cover those carbs. But then after you've done that for a bit, you've done the weighing and you've done all of that, you sort of become a bit of a ninja about it. I can look at a lot of foods and just tell you the grammage of carbs and how much I'll need to inject for that. Yeah.
And how many times do you have to inject every day?
It depends, really. So I inject before I eat. So, you know, it's at least 3 times for that. And then there's another long acting insulin, which I do in the morning. So it's 4 times minimum. But then if my blood sugar's high or I'm eating more than normal or less than normal, it might be 1 or 2 less than that. Yeah.
There's a condition that I was reading about, not in relation to this, by the way, but some time ago, where it's almost diabetics willfully ignore the problem. And it's a big thing for the medical profession, because you say it's out of sight, out of mind. If you can't actively feel that something's going on, then you just put it to one side. And I sort of feel that, I mean, I'm not diabetic, but, you know, I take medication for a brain thing, and it's just... when you feel better, it's easy to just go, it's all right.
Yeah.
I did that over lockdown. That was very, very bad.
Yeah, it's not ideal. I mean, there's various things connect. There's diabetic burnout, where people are just fed up with having to look after it, so just decide to ignore it. Or there's, you know, there's eating disorders connected with it as well. There's diabulimia, I think is the term that the press like to use, where, because if I didn't give my insulin and push my blood sugars really high, I wouldn't be that hungry. Ever. So people can use it as like a way of stopping themselves eating too much, and that is not advisable in any way.
No.
So there are lots of things like that associated with it. But also, I found when I got it on track and I brought my blood sugars into range a lot of the time, I felt way better. And it turns out when I was sort of semi-ignoring it or only doing the bare minimum, I didn't feel good. I just, that's just how I felt all of the time. And I got used to it. Whereas now I know what it feels like when I'm not looking after it, and it's not fun.
No, I just became a little bit careless. I thought, I just sort of was in slight denial, and you know, because I felt better, I just eased the foot off the pedal. And then because my thing's in my brain, if my brain goes haywire, there's nothing to tell me that it's gone haywire, because of course, I'm just inhabiting that reality.
Yeah.
And so then you're relying on other people going, hello, nut job.
Yeah, which I guess
get back on the pills, love.
And your brain's not going to interpret that.
No,
in the
not
right
well.
Way. Yeah.
No, just like, why is everyone having a go at me? Why
yeah, I'm
is everyone
fine.
So at you? And it really interests me, that really, the idea, you know, most people don't have to actively engage in self-care to the degree that you do. They don't have to be mindful of everything that goes into their body, be attuned in a rather mindful way to the beats of your of and the rhythms of your body.
But I've always said as well, I think that's one of the weird advantages of it, in that I think I am more in tune with my body than a lot of people are. So I think I do generally probably live a healthier lifestyle in an attempt to make up some of the ground that diabetes takes away. So, you know, I do exercise a lot, and I try and eat healthily to keep my blood sugars in check. So just because I know what makes me feel good and I know how to do it.
Which makes sense. And that's why, well, anyway, it's had a huge impact on my mate. So,
oh, that's good. No, I always like to hear that. That's lovely.
And it's good that you can do it, as I say, just in the normal run of a show. You can drop that bomb. You can have a gag and then carry on with. You could be rolling with something else.
Well, what I found about it was, as well, when I was trying to write a big bit about being diabetic, is that not a lot of people know what it is or why type 1 is different to type 2 or anything like that. So that I had so much more mileage in it, but just by defining type 1 diabetes, I can get plenty of, and not, there's no one else really talking about it. And it's lovely to have an angle.
Everyone needs a thing.
And, you know, I don't, other than that, I don't really have a thing, because I look and I look and sound like most comedians who've been on television for the last 20 years.
But you've got a thing now.
Yes, finally. Although I feel like I may have exhausted the thing already.
You know, I dabbled in the LA of it all.
You did dabble. Yes, you did.
Because it was that sort of, like, I set myself up and made some connections, and now I've run back to the country in Australia. I'm just living in a small town.
And is that safer for you? You feel happy at that?
Oh, it's much better, much the best. I don't I have trouble navigating social situations that with people I've known for years. And, you know, Hollywood is an extreme version of that, and it's fraught, and no one is it sounds like a cliche. It's like, no one's real. You can't afford to be real. It's just
there's no time.
It's just what it is, but it's not for people with autism. It's like, I'm too blunt. I hurt people's feelings, and they're so sensitive, and that's fine. Good on them. They're artists. But I kept meeting people, and I'm like, no idea who you are.
What's so the most LA thing, in inverted commas, that you did? What's the after the Netflix special?
What's the most LA thing that I did?
Yeah.
Well, meetings. I did meetings.
Well, of course you did meetings. That's the quintessence of the LA experience.
My favorite. But I was like, I was having the meetings people would kill for, and I'd never dreamt of it, because it was never on my radar. Like, because you just look, I'm not a fool. Like, I have ambitions, but I've sort of maintained them in the sort of craft and the art of it.
Yeah, we grew up performing in caves in Edinburgh. You don't go from a cave to, you know, the Man Theatre.
So I don't sort of like didn't go there like, you know, I didn't, and because Nanette was really a one song in a spec. Like, it's not like I had like a cheeky sitcom in my back pocket. So there are these people like, what do you want to do now? And I'm like, I'm tired. So in a way I kind of squandered the moment, but I don't think I did because it just was too slippery for me and I was exhausted and I don't think I would have made a great decision even if I had a cheeky sitcom in my back pocket. But I was having these meetings and I was just like, and I know like the, you know, I know people who's, you know, have been writing sitcoms for a long time and, you know, I have friends who would just, I won't tell them of these meetings. They're the ones that they've been angling for and they meet the, you know, entry level gatekeepers. And here I am with the head of Warner Brothers and he's taking me on his golf cart. And I'm like, this is wasted on me. Let me give you a tour. The head of Warner Brothers.
What?
Gave me a, yeah.
In a golf, what, round the studio?
Yeah. And I'm like.
Sure it was the head of Warner Brothers and not one of those kids that just does the, you know, like the Universal
Taz.
Stuff.
It's Taz Devil. So it was kind of incredible. But we had this big meeting and we tried to get the sizes down because, like I said, I'm quite unable to do more than three people comfortably and just keep track of what I'm saying and who I'm saying it to and hearing everything that's going on. I have this thing as a auditory processing disorder where if I can't prioritize sound, so in a noisy environment a really quiet sound is the same as the loudest sound. It just comes in and I can't sort out the importance, so I really struggle, hence the beer. But you can't take beers on meetings.
Not in LA you can't.
No. Well, they can't, don't even do tea. And that was the thing about this, because they'd seen the show and they're like, oh, you want tea? And I don't think they expected me to say yes, because they're always, you know, taking these great big, you know, cartons of coffee around, chugging it back. They're very busy people. And so they had that facility. I could have had a big, and I'm like, no, I would really like a tea. I didn't think it was too much to ask, but apparently it was. And the head of Warner Brothers.
What's interesting about those meetings, though, is they want to know, what do you want to do? And there's no friction. And I don't you think that sometimes you need the friction to make the art?
Well, I found the friction. That's my
Did
gift.
Did you? Yeah. in the cart?
Yes, because it was in the room and it was like they had this massive table and they filled it up with a lot of people and he's like, I'll make you a tea. And everyone's just like, what? He's making the tea. And so then there was this kerfuffle.
Is he showing you it could be normal? He's going, I can be a regular guy.
It worked. He was really sweet. I mean, he might have, I don't know enough to have an informed opinion. I don't know what I think about it. But he was nice to me. He was very lovely. And he filled the paper cup up with boiling hot water from the urn, like whatever place, kitchen. Don't know how it works, but it was boiling hot. Like it was just, and then this tea bag in it and then milk before it had, so the milk was in before the tea.
That's wrong.
So it was just, you get it, right? And it's fine. I was like, oh, God, but I couldn't even hold it. It was so hot. And then it started melting the glue that keeps the cups together because it was so hot. And because usually I guess they have coffee in this boiling hot water situation and milk, and so it cools it down. But this cup was melting as everyone's introducing themselves to me around
the
table.
Vice president of...
Yeah, and I met the dude who does the... they had the reality TV stuff people in. Reality
structured,
TV.
Structured reality or augmented reality. Or,
yeah, and I'm like... Yeah. I don't know why you're here.
I'd love to see
But good on you. And they're like, a few of them are just like, I'm involved in The Bachelor. And I'm like, cool.
Wasted on both you and me, that. It's not right? Something we're going to do.
And so, but one of them said, I'm involved in The Bachelor. It's very popular. Very popular in Australia. I don't know if you know that. And I'm like, I've got this burning hot tea that's melting onto this mahogany table. And I'm just like, I don't know when to say something about this. And then she said, it's very popular in Australia, The Bachelor. I'm not sure about Tanzania.
Okay, well done. Yep.
And so half the room were like nodding and the other half knew that I'm from Tasmania, not Africa. And so they're just like, And I'm like, oh, it's Tasmania. My cup's melting. And then it was over.
Is that it? So there was just basically a slow eruption of boiling liquid, a geographical correction. And then.
So that was my meeting with Warner Brothers. They were lovely. And I'm like, what I learned is that it's just a process of schmoozing. Yeah, then there's other meetings, follow-up meetings. And everyone's so nice. Which
so
is
nice.
Difficult to navigate because I think it is that friction. There's nothing to hang on to.
Did you always resist the stateside life?
Because
you won. When did you win Oscars? How old were you?
About 32,
33. My God.
The first one for Howard's End. And then I think I was 37 or something when I won for Sense, the writing one.
Bloody hell. How does, that's just the double by 37.
Yes, but it's not, it doesn't feel like that. It's not like that. Because you're not even aware, you're not aware of it. I mean, I was so innocent about things like the Oscars. They weren't really a big thing in our lives here in England.
I used to stay up and watch them.
Yeah, but you're younger than me, sweetheart.
But it was the most unspeakably glamorous thing from when I was a
yes.
kid. Because it's so outside of my realm of experience, achievement, whatever it might be. And also, I happy childhood, but very the sort of endless rolling beigeness of Croydon. And
I've played Croydon.
You play it once. Not even on the way up and the way down. You just play it once.
I played it once, the Croydon Warehouse. I had a very good audience.
Do you know what? The Warehouse was great. It's the Fairfield Halls you've got to watch out for. It's a fab venue, but acoustically difficult. Acoustically very difficult. God, anyway, that's a very niche comment by me. But for me, it was always like, maybe it was about the fact that people wore ball gowns, which I knew I would thankfully never have to squeeze myself into. But it's like, don't these people in ball gowns? And they still managed to walk. And I used to feel so frightened when I would see them teeter up the steps.
Yes.
And even then I think, God, what a needlessly stressful thing to make a woman do. She's
Indeed.
Already shitting herself.
Exactly.
That she's got to pick this thing up. Don't and do a nice speech.
Don't. Am I the shoes? No. And you just spend... I can remember one year, actually the year I won for Sense and Sensibility, I had a pair of shoes on. And they just wouldn't stay on, and they were too high, and they wouldn't stay on. And I was thinking, what am I going to do? I can't get down the bloody red carpet in these. And who was it? It was somebody who was staying in the hotel. She was queen of somewhere. I can't remember what country.
She was
a fucking queen. And I was just passing the thing. And I said, Have you got anything I could, have you got any sellotape, have you? Or it was, and she said, she said, I'm wearing some, you don't mind borrowing these. I mean, I have been wearing these shoes and she had some insoles. She said, do you want them? So, and they were all kind of warm. A hot queen's insoles I got. And I put them on and they saved my bacon, can I tell you?
That is majestic. The fact that you're, because I do imagine that everyone's just rubbing around, all these sort of A-listers rubbing their center. And the queen of somewhere, you didn't even ask
remember.
Where, perhaps you were too
I can't
dazzled,
remember where.
Gave you a hot insole so that you could teeter up and accept this big bastard gold man.
In that sense, high heels are quite a leveling experience, because all the women are in agony. I will not wear them anymore.
We started talking about the synergy between human and animal medicine, or your desire for there to be more synergy. And just talking about that story and what you're going through, you talk about medical intervention and biology. And of course, human disease, medical intervention doesn't stop suffering. As you say, we don't have a euthanasia pathway, or at least not an official one. And I was, even though I count the death of my first dog as one of the two most painful memories of my entire life, I know that as awful as that decision was that I took, it stopped further suffering. The other most painful thing in my life, which was the death of my father, I just watched. Because we had all the same, we had the diagnosis, we had the treatment, but what we didn't have was, when the treatment could go no further, an option to stop suffering. And I think there's a lot that we can learn about dignity and dying from the way that vets treat animals. And one day I hope we get to move it into the human model, because I wouldn't wish anyone to watch another human being suffer like that.
Yeah, the one thing that I would add to that is, though, that where is the line in the sand? So as in Kira's case, some people would say put her to sleep on day one.
Yeah.
So we do have a great challenge ahead. The biggest challenge is not the evolution of technology. I think that's going to change. Look, there's a phrase out there, change is going to happen anyway, progress is optional.
Mm.
And I think progress is going to be an ethical framework which allows us a triage system of choices. That is very difficult, because it can be quite simplistic to say, well, we have euthanasia as an option in veterinary medicine, so therefore we're going to do the right thing. And of course we are. Of course every veterinarian is going to try and do the right thing. But you got to put yourself in my position, knowing that I could put Kira to sleep on day one because she's so badly traumatized. How do you make that decision, and within which context do you move forward? And it's very subjective.
But you know the animal, so that's your companion. You know more than anybody what her trajectory could be with a fair wind.
Well, that's a really interesting point, Sue. So here's a question for you. Who knows better, the person that knows the animal or the veterinarian?
I think it's got to be a dialogue, hasn't it? Because, for example, if you were treating my dog, I could say, she's not right. You have to believe me, who lives with her day in, day out, she's not right. I would hope you do believe me. But once you have believed me, I would hope I believe you when you tell me this is the best pathway of treatment.
And this is exactly the point. So it needs to be a dialogue.
Yeah.
So that is the correct answer, in my opinion. In other words, it has to be a dialogue between veterinary medicine and the animal families who love these animals.
. 2021 has pretty much picked up where 2020 left off. And for those of us who suffer with anxiety and stress, it hasn't been easy. But our long-term sponsors, Grass & Co., can help with that. Grass & Co. is a premium CBD range that blends the highest quality CBD with therapeutic botanical ingredients. The organic CBD and botanical formulations have been specially created to relax your mind and soothe your body. Find your lockdown calm with grassandco.com. The best-selling Calm CBD range includes botanicals Evening Primrose, Ashwagandha and Chamomile. To find out more, head over to grassandco.com/hour. If you're new to CBD, their best-selling 500mg Calm CBD oil is a great starting point. As with all supplements, CBD is going to affect everyone differently, so just start low and steadily build your dosage every day until you find the balance that works with your body. The Grass & Co. Calm range brings peace and tranquility to your day with CBD consumable oils, nourishing body oils and peaceful pillow sprays. Grass & Co., I'm delighted to say, have supported this podcast since the start. And now you can get 25% off the entire Grass & Co. Calm, Ease and Rest CBD ranges. Plus you'll get free shipping. Just head over to www.grassandco.com/hour and use the discount code HOUR, that's H-O-U-R, at the checkout. Grass & Co. Life enhanced by nature.
I it's funny. I talked to Louis Theroux a couple of days ago, and he was my nemesis. And it was really brave of me to do it. I've never spoke to him. In my mind, he took my job. The last time I saw him, I gave not one but two BAFTAs. And we had a conversation for about 2.5 hours where I just said, here's what, it's not you, here's what you represent to me. Because at a certain time, I was fired from my job. It wasn't fired, I was asked to do things that were so disgraceful that eventually I got so fucking depressed. I had to be put away. I have depression anyway. You know, TV shows don't make you depressed. It's a disease. But coincidentally, I got really ill. And when I came out, I thought, I'm going to learn about my mind. So in a way, I have to thank him for him and Al Niento, you know, because I was too old to be on television. I was 50.
So I would have, by now, I would have been made into chopped liver. But
I'm 50 and I'm a mental tub. Now, I do feel that.
Got 10 more minutes. This show is not going to finish. Let me just tell you, if you're 50, you're done. No, you might be okay. But
That's good to know. I feel validated.
You'll be okay. But I wasn't going to be okay. And I only had that disease of celebrity. I had the disease. I caught it from people who were famous. But anyway, I had to wean off. I got on tubes saying, do you know who I am? And they go, no, pay the fucking ticket. You know what I mean? Because I thought,
did you do that? Did you do the do you know who I am?
In the beginning, I was insane. And I started going to school to become a psychotherapist. Gradually, I was just a student. You know, I forgot what I did in show business. I had new friends and I'd carry my books and go to the cafeteria. And then I had another breakdown. And then I thought, I'm really going to figure out how my mind works as much as I can. You know, not, we don't know anything. We're in the foothills, but I want to know what I would have studied had I had a brain when I was young. So I crashed a course in neuroscience at UCL, and they were all 21. And I said to them that this isn't a joke. I said, I have that disease where you age really fast. And anyway, I stayed there. And then I looked up and then they let me go with them, but I had a car, so I got kind of popular. Yeah. And then I thought, where's the most evidence of what works as far as being able to lower the cortisol? Because I knew what damage that did, the stress hormone. And I was fried. You know, whatever got me into show business, which was the drive of a Rottweiler, in my 30s and 40s started to backfire, and I'd crash into walls. Anyway, you know what I mean? I'd use the same power for nothing. And then mindfulness and cognitive therapy had the most evident, you know, most positive results, not 100%. So I found the guy who invented mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, one of the guys. He was a professor at Oxford. And I said, I got to know what happens in your brain. I have to know. I don't want to wave crystals, which you have. I know, don't hold it up.
This is the woman who just smacked a sort of luminescent potty to make a noise out of it. I'm not going to take that from you.
It's not luminescent.
We're all doing what we need to get by.
It's turquoise. I'm not luminescent.
I look luminescent on the Zoom.
Okay. So he said, if you want to learn about the brain, you got to get into Oxford. Like you. Did you go to Oxford?
I went to Cambridge, but to be honest, who cares?
Yeah, well, now when you're in your late 50s, I cared. And now I was really interested in how the mind works, not when I was young. And it changed you know, to write a book on neuroscience and comedy, Louis can't take that from me.
Was Louis terrified by the fact that you pinned all this on him?
No, because I did it. You know, I had some people holding my hand here because it had to be done with no anger and no agenda. It was just, here's what I've projected on you for all these years. And you might like to hear it or not, you know, but I'm not going to be interviewed and go, hey, let's talk about my book. This is going to be fun. If you're asking me to talk to you, I'll talk to you. And he really, it was like a closure. You know what I mean? I feel
that's great.
Yeah. I feel like that A was courage, and B, I said, it wasn't really you, but you know, because of my dad being so violent and men taking things from me and stuff, it's not about show business. It's about what you represent. And it always is. And I think to be able to say it is kind of healing.
Remember your first prosthetic?
Yes. So my first, I mean, I don't remember. My mum still got them.
She?
Yeah. She's got them. There's a collection. So the first is just... So my right foot, if you were to put your hand into a fist,
yeah,
and basically go like that, that's kind of what my foot looks like. It's a little stump and you bend your wrist back. So I've got a heel. I can take weight on it.
Okay.
And I guess probably for the first few years of my life, the height difference between my left and right foot wasn't that pronounced. So really the first thing I had on my right foot was just a little leather boot, really, mm-hmm. that was almost made in the shape of the stump. And I guess I don't remember walking around in that. I've only seen it because my mum's kept it. then after that, the next thing was a shoe, which had like a brace, I guess you would call it, at the back, and my stomach
was attached.
Yeah.
To your calf.
Yes. Yeah. And then it would strap around the front of my calf. But that, I guess that was the only shoe I could wear for, you know, a good couple of years until I grew, and then another prosthetic was made that was slightly bigger that I could take in and out of other shoes. I mean, the one I've joked about it on stage, but the one thing that I was never able to do was wear flip-flops. They could never.
You bad Australian.
And literally, they tried to come up with technology that would allow me to wear flip-flops. Because I think at about the age of maybe 12 or 13, the doctors, you know, in that kind of, is there anything the other kids can do that you wish you could do? And I went, yeah, I want to wear thongs, which is what we call them. So they then made a prosthetic with a gap in it where the toes are, so that you could put the flip-flop in. But of course, I didn't realize when you walk with a flip-flop, you actually grip with your toes so that it doesn't fall off. So every time I walked, it would just fly off the front.
So you have to shuffle, presumably. You'd have to keep the foot fairly close to the floor.
So then, and that didn't work. So then my mum stuck a bit of Velcro to the bottom of my foot and to the top of the flip-flop to see if that would work. And it didn't, God bless her. Thankfully for me, sandals came back into fashion.
Yep. I love the fact that you were so keen to have that. But they tried. That's amazing, though, that they go, okay, we're going to make your life better by building a bit. It's like a built-in sort of open a forked toe that would facilitate a thong.
That's exactly what it was.
Imagine if you'd gone in the next time going, no, I want to wear a stiletto, or I want to wear some langlaufing boots, or I want to, you know, you could have had a prosthetic for every different footwear occasion.
The one that I do have, so when I get my prosthetic made these days, I have to take in whatever shoe I currently own that has the highest heel on it.
Okay.
And they make the prosthetic according to that. And then if I'm wearing other shoes, then I have to chalk up the heel because I can't adjust my ankle for the heel. So it's easier if I do it on a flat surface and then I put on something with a heel, it throws my whole leg and hip forward and it doesn't quite. So yeah, if I did want to wear stilettos, my point is, they would make a prosthetic that would accommodate that.
And do you get sort of, if you don't jack up the heel to the right level, do you find that you get sort of associated sort of pain in your knees and your hips and stuff?
Constant hip and back. Not constant, but a lot of hip and back pain, especially as I get older. You know, the body doesn't adjust as well as it used to. So I'm finding that I need to do Pilates, I need to do stretches. The older I get, the more I need to do stuff.
Getting older is shit, isn't it? I mean, in one way, it's great because I don't know about you, but I care less about the things that don't matter. Mm-hmm. And I can constructively engage better with the things that are important.
Yeah.
But getting out of bed, the groaning, and it just goes on and on and on. And actually, it's only about, for me, at midday, I start to think, oh, yeah, that's it. Everything's working. And then I sit and work, and then everything seizes up again until I go to bed. It's just shit.
Do you remember the last time you woke up feeling good and refreshed? Because I genuinely don't.
Well, no, not really. No, not. I mean, and I don't know what my excuse is because I don't have kids, but I think I'm probably going back a good 10 years.
Yeah, at least. I literally remember one morning in Montreal during the comedy festival waking up thinking, oh, I feel good today. And I think that's the last time 15 years ago that I woke up feeling good.
Maybe Montreal's your lucky charm. Maybe you should go there. Maybe something in the air or something. But it's just, it's the niggles. And, you know, thank God, you know, nothing else. But it's just, we're not old. We're not the ancients.
The last time I had a proper checkup with my doctor in Melbourne, she kind of said, you know, what exercise are you doing? And I said, look, I play golf. I play a little bit of tennis. I'm not really big for running. I'll go to the gym occasionally. And she said, good, no, they're the right things to do. And she said, look, she was about the same age as me. She said, at our age, exercise isn't about keeping fit. It's about not dying.
That's a GP I can get on board with. It's just death prevention. Yeah. Have this extraordinary relationship with your daughter.
Yeah.
So, and who is such an independent, I mean, I've only met her, I think, twice, but such an independent spirit. I was very struck by that. What a fully formed little person she was already. Like, out of the box. Of course, it isn't out of the box. It's, it ties you with your parenting and the relationship you have. But interesting that you saw yourself as, you know, as a sort of single person, but probably because she's also so singular. So the two of you can kind of coexist, but in unique worlds.
Well, this might be a little too Edinburgh for you, but I was thinking with the show title Misses, I was like, is there some artistic way where I can part the letters and make it Miss Us at the end? Because I really do miss that relationship that I had with her and that time in my life as well.
So that's an interesting thing though, isn't it? That people don't talk about. So perfect in a way for a show, in that you have this time as a single person, and the reward is that you have this incredible clarity in your relationship with your daughter. And then that gets, I don't want to say muddied, because I don't want to bring anything negative into that, because obviously you're really, really happy. But so what is the shift?
Well, I think the shift was happening anyway, and whatever incarnation of the universe you believe in, I almost think that goddess was like, Catherine, you need a new partner in crime because this one doesn't want to be friends with you anymore. And I did rely on Violet, my daughter, to be my best friend. And we were so close, and we slept in the same bed, and we lived in this democracy, just so, so close for so many years. And then I could feel that slipping away. And I think what potentially a lot of single parents might be doing when they construct their lives that way is really setting themselves up for an early empty nest syndrome, because children do go to secondary school. She's 11 now. She's invested in her community there. I'm not that cool anymore. She has other influences and other people she wants to hang out with. And all of a sudden I've been massively demoted, and it really hurts. I think a lot of people feel that when the kids go to uni or whatever they do, they move out. But this year has really struck me that she's gone. And I feel guilty because I know people who've actually, you know, God forbid, lost their children. I know my daughter is still here, but that little person is definitely gone. And that is a real trauma for me. That's hard.
I think I'm not lucky enough to be a parent, but I'm a godmom, and I'm an aunt. And but it seems to me that there's an art of losing a child in plain sight.
Yeah.
There are periods of such intense connectivity, obviously most profoundly when they can't speak and they're sort of physically attached to you. But the letting go is, I don't know how you do that. So my sister's just had a baby, and I just want to eat this little thing. She's just permanently on me, and she still smells milky, and she's giggling all the time. And I just think, no, I don't want you. When you're here now, don't you be leaving. I can't imagine how hard that is when, yeah, as you say, they're 11 and they're like, I got my own shit going on.
Right. Well, congratulations. Yeah. They're so cute when they're babies.
Yeah, they are cute.
And I've done a terrible thing to my parents. I mean, my mother loves me. Everyone in my family loves me because I'm so cool. And I moved an ocean away, and I had a baby over here, and I hardly even call them. I mean, I am an evil, terrible daughter.
You're a shit daughter.
Yeah.
And Violet is their revenge upon you.
She really is. And I've been dumped.
What interests me is about that, the way that you describe performing it, because you performed in, you know, dozens and dozens of, you know, major cities around the world. It seems to me that every night on some level, you were re-experiencing the trauma. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's a protection that comes with repetition, but I'm not a performer. Like, it's not the same as acting.
No.
There's not a protection, and I don't do that. But there is a protection that comes with repetition, but I understood that. So I never, the whole show is really finely crafted except for the last 10 minutes. And I never locked those in.
Oh, okay.
So if you were to see the show more than once, you would never experience the same 10 minutes at the end. There was about 30 minutes of material that I would pluck out So I was very much, so the reason I did that was to keep me in the room every night because I felt like that was the responsible thing to do. You cannot phone that kind of trauma in.
No.
I had a responsibility to be and understand what the room was every night because I was, it's a dangerous thing to do to, you know, that's why they have trigger warnings, you know, to, and part of the show was about like, you don't need trigger warnings if people cared, like if the performer cared about what they're talking about. Like, it's not throwaways. It's not there for a tool to laugh. It's like, it is about that tension and that trauma. And part of the show was an experiment in that. It was like, the reason we have trigger warnings is because we live in a world where people don't care about other people's traumas. It's just jokes.
Yeah, it's not experiences.
But yeah, so by keeping that last 10 minutes absolutely live, I felt like I was able to be, you know, keep that responsibility. So there was, you know, so that though was a double-edged sword for me because it meant that there's dread and trauma. Like, as I'm doing the show, like I'm
back.
I'm uneasy.
Yeah.
Why I think that the performance came into that.
Oh, no, but you know, when I interviewed celebrities, which I didn't like, because I used to do documentaries that Louis took from me, but saying it with love. But anyway, I love the documentaries. And then they said, do some celebrities. I didn't know they'd make me do it for 5 years. Is that it was really a study of the illness of fame. Yeah. So I enjoyed it. Then I got it, right? I could have written a thesis. And I said, okay, can I go back to doing documentaries? And they said, no. But I really studied fame like it was an illness. And I mean, I made great friends out of it, but it is an illness.
What is it John Irving that said, or John Updike rather, who said fame is a mask that eats the face? But oh, idea that it's good. Ivy. Yeah,
I think it's very good.
Somebody smarter than me will correct me if I've got that wrong. But yeah, it is. It's that idea that ivy just surrounds the tree, but it's not decorating the tree, it's eating the tree.
Oh, that's good.
You said that you caught the celebrity disease. But it's strange to me because you actually were one of the few people providing a critical perspective, critical narrative on that.
I know, but when you play tennis with a pro, you become a pro. So because I was, not when I was in documentaries, but when I started, you know, hanging with Sharon Stone and things, I got excited like I was a little girl and prom queen liked me. Yeah. It rubbed off. I started tap dancing for him rather than treating, you know what I mean?
If I was around pretty people, I wouldn't believe, because I've never been around pretty people. They're not me and they're not my tribe. But, you know, when a pretty person at school would just like look at you or be friends with you, it's like
That's terrible, isn't it? I know. I tried to make them like me. And then there were some people like Donald Trump who really hated me. That's a badge of honor.
I forgot you interviewed him.
Yeah.
I remember, of course, Imelda Marcos. I can remember, well, you know, these things I remember. But my God, you could have just ended it.
I could have busted him if I wasn't so over. He made me too nervous, so I asked stupid questions. If when he said, I want to be the next president of the United States, I would have just leaned forward and said, tell me what your plans are, without trying to be funny, which I was, he might have hung himself. But instead, I tried to be, you know, I did, you know, when the fight and flight goes, you can't think straight anymore.
So was he intimidating? I mean, what was he?
Scary. But like my father squared. He was the scariest human being I've ever met in my life. The hatred coming off him.
Why? Because you
because I wasn't sexy. You know,
well, he didn't not, understand. Not to him. Not to him.
No, but I wasn't playing that card. And then at the end, when I got in a car with him and the sound was off, he started telling me what he likes to do with women and how he treats them. And rather than me going, Blanche, I'm so offended, I started being cruder than he was. And then he liked me because I was one of the guys.
And then you go home and you feel shame.
I go home and I feel shame, but I got him. You know what I mean? I got him.
Well, you saw him. Yeah.
Yeah. And I matched him. And then when the show was aired, my next guest was John McEnroe, who said to me, I met Trump and he said, if he ever sees you again, he's going to kill you. So I guess I did get him, just like my dad.
It's amazing, said, though, isn't it? How he's going to kill me. Idle threats from. Yeah. Idols. The idea that someone can even say that glibly is just.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. I hope for a second somebody got under his skin.
That's why I have my tinger.
Yeah.
If he ever comes near me, I'm ready.
I'm going to do that. And maybe, do you know what? This seems like a good place to end. If we just clear the energy, we've mentioned the Trump word.
Okay.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue, all I do is stare at the view. I'll be heading find my peace where the desert feasts.